Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be chatting with Kelly Shortridge, formerly a detection manager at BAE, all about her Black Hat talk. It's about why most of what you hear about applying game theory to detection strategies is total f***ing bullshit. This week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences. Signal Sciences makes a killer product focused on web application and web server security. It is really popular with the DevOps crowd, which is interesting, actually, because most security products in DevOps focus on the dev, whereas Signal Sciences focuses more on the ops component. So this week we speak to Signal Sciences co-founder Zane Lackey about this burgeoning market for security tooling geared towards non-security people. It's actually a really interesting conversation, and this is a real trend in the InfoSec space that you would ignore at your peril, let's put it that way. Non-security groups at large organizations are having to become security self-sufficient, and it really is a game changer. More on that with Zane Lackey in this week's sponsor interview. But before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, yeah, about a day after we recorded the last podcast, Marcus Hutchins, aka Malware Tech Blog, on Twitter, the so-called accidental hero of WannaCry, that guy got arrested trying to go home from Vegas.
Yeah, so he was apparently leaving Las Vegas. So he was in town around the time of Black Hat and DEF CON, although their reporting is that he didn't actually go to either of the cons. But yeah, he was in town. And then he got picked up whilst he was on the plane, like whilst the plane was getting ready to take off, and taken into custody. And the indictment that's been released is that he was the author and was selling a banking Trojan, the Kronos banking Trojan, or at least was one of the people involved in selling it. And yeah, they're holding him for that, which is an interesting twist to the story.
Yeah, I think he's made bail and he's on route to Wisconsin. The indictment itself is getting a lot of flack, and I got to say, like, I'm not a lawyer, but I read through it and it's pretty thin.
Yeah, so they're kind of asserting what that he wrote it and made some like videos describing its features, but.
And that, might have and maybe you know, helped they sold sell it, once. It on Alphabay or something for $2,000 one time. Like it's like if this is it, if this is the entire DOJ case, then you really got to wonder why they bothered.
Yeah, I mean, certainly $2,000 worth of malware sales doesn't seem like the sort of large scale criminal conspiracy that you might expect from a banking Trojan. But I mean, you're right. Like there must be more to the story because it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense at the moment. And I think that's the thing that's been. Everyone's reaction to this is like, well, what's going on? Like, it doesn't seem to make sense. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, clearly it's going to come out, but yeah, at the moment we're all a bit confused.
Yeah, well, the rumor mill is in absolute overdrive. We're seeing everybody saying, I think I sent a tweet the other day saying, depending on who you believe, he's either totally innocent or he created WannaCry and was the gunman on the grassy knoll. it's kind of hard to know what's going on. But look, I have to say there are rumors, and I've got to point out, of course, that they're completely unsubstantiated rumors, but there are rumors flying around that he may have been involved in crimeware stuff in the past. And I guess we just have to wait to see if there's an updated indictment, because if there's not, as I say, I wouldn't understand why the FBI would bother if this is the totality of the charges they have against him. So there might be more. We just don't know. We should also note that Marcus Hutchins is planning to plead not guilty to the charges. So could be some fun times ahead from if you're a commentator in this space. So it's good news for us.
Yeah, certainly for now, I think he bit off a little more than he could chew going to Vegas. And perhaps if you have a shady past at all, don't go to the US quite so much.
Yeah, like even if you were just a dabbler, probably not a good idea. Now, look, speaking of WannaCry, apparently around $140,000 worth of Bitcoin got emptied from three wallets related to the spread of the second version. So that's kind of interesting. And another notable thing is that the emptying process was exactly the same as the process used for the Bitcoins involved with the one, version one.
Yeah, which is an interesting sort of coincidence. I don't know whether it's coincidence or whether there's just not very many good ways of kind of getting your Bitcoin out when everyone's watching. Like it may just be that's the way you got to do it. But yeah, some people are making hay out of the similarities in the mechanism in which the stash from WannaCry 1, which, kind of wasn't the North Koreans, and WannaCry 2, which, apparently was the North Koreans, the similarity between two. And I'm not sure whether, whether I buy that particularly. But I think the thing that amused me most about this story was the headline on Motherboard, which was "Hackers behind WannaCry cashed out Bitcoin while no one was watching, except for the fact that there were Twitter bots watching the blockchain." And indeed, everybody turns out was watching the blockchain because that's what the blockchain's for. So yes, no prizes for that headline.
Now, look, Adam, this next piece, I just feel like we wouldn't be doing our jobs if we didn't cover it. It's not technically a security news story, but it does affect a lot of people in the field that we cover. This dude bro from Google and his goddamn manifesto.
Yeah, it's certainly been making waves on the internet. It seems like some... as you say, some dude bro at Google read a little bit too much EvPsych 101 and had himself a bit of a rant, which then got leaked from the internal Google forum out to the wider internet. And yes, many toys were thrown out of many cots, including the guy in question who appears to have gotten fired from Google.
Look, I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this is there's a difference, right? There's a difference between discussing the merits of diversity programs and how those things are structured. There might be a conversation to be had there, but this manifesto that a lot of people are sort of defending without having read, I mean, the first page is sort of provocative and interesting and you want to see where it goes. And then it veers off into, girls can't computer because childhood testosterone. And it does that very quickly. I mean, it really is a steaming pile of sexist bullshit. And I just sort of feel like, we have to call that out because, you know, it's not just dude bros in this industry. It's never just been dude bros in this industry, and it's becoming a more inclusive industry, and that's a good thing. So I don't get why people are defending this guy. Do you?
No, I don't either. And obviously, you know, as organizer of KiwiCon, we've done a lot of work trying to build, you know, a HackerCon that is, you know, sort of friendly and inclusive and has a relatively diverse audience. And I would struggle to see any other cons of the kind of size that KiwiCon is that's really done, you know, as much of a good job, hopefully, as we have. And that really is a road that is not paved with the kind of, you know, rules weaseling sort of, you know, engineering mindset that this guy tried to apply to fundamentally what is a much more complicated problem. I mean, it's, it's just not as simple, and it's certainly, you know, relying on ladies used to hunt and gather, therefore they like berries, therefore that's why they like shoes, because they're pink like berries. It's like bullshit. It's just not, you know, not a thing that's going to go. Clearly it's not a thing that went well for him. But yeah, it's just not a thing that we have to put up with in this industry. And I am sorry to all the listeners that do have to put up with that crap.
So, yeah. Mm, yeah, well, dude bro plans to sue. Good luck to you, mate, because I'm pretty sure that sexism actually isn't political speech. So I don't know how you're going to go. Now, look, before we move on from this, I just want to read a little section of text here that crossed my desk from a woman I know who attended Black Hat. And she wrote of her experience, and I'm quoting here, "The worst was definitely, you know," and this is Black Hat. This is the professional InfoSec con. So, you know, just next time you think that, oh, women are complaining for no reason, just keep this in mind. So I'll quote directly here. "The worst was definitely the potential customer who, after I made a comment about not liking how dry Vegas weather is and preferring humidity, he mock-stroked my face to the point where I could still feel it without actual touching. And he said, 'I bet you do with that skin.'" Ugh, shudder. "But then there was my plane seatmate on the way over who asked if I was one of those booth chicks, or the fact that I can walk around the vendor hall uninterrupted, even stand at the booth for minutes without anyone approaching me as male visitors are immediately greeted, or avoiding the big vendor parties since even at the con itself, men will blatantly leer and give the up and down, or accidentally find a reason to move past me and place their hand on the small of my back. I realize this isn't the reality of the Black Hat experience for most of you, which is exactly why I want to highlight it. This is just a taste of what happened to me, someone who specifically tailored their activities to avoid the chance of being on the receiving end of inappropriate conduct. I'm lucky enough that I've already established a network in the community, but having to skip events for fear of being creeped on, or worse, reduces female attendees' ability to network, particularly those just entering the industry." So, dude, bro, when you say that hormones make women incapable of being good engineers, I'd suggest that it's actually people like you and the way you think about women, which is what's keeping women engineers away from workplaces like Google. So Just go away, dude, bro. And all his supporters as well. It's just, I mean, I just can't even believe that there are people supporting this guy.
Yeah, like we really do not need to be having this conversation at this point, like in liberal, civilized life. Like, just piss off.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Let's move on to some more InfoSec stuff here. This is an interesting story from Vice Motherboard for a number of reasons, but apparently a bunch of election officials in the United States, you know, who are obviously going to be tasked with repelling attacks from nation states in you know, a whole swathe of upcoming elections in the United States next year, they haven't received their security clearances yet to view information pertaining to Russian hacking efforts. I'm in two minds about this because on one hand, I think, well, you know, they need to get their clearances. But on the other hand, I think, well, surely the federal government should be able to declassify enough to give them a solid briefing.
Yeah, like I think both of these things ought to be things that are happening. I mean, clearly stuff gets overclassified. I mean, we see some of the information that comes out of the, you know, the trust groups in the US that has originally come from the FBI. And it's all just so ridiculously overclassified rubbish. So it really doesn't need to have that degree of oversight. And then on the other hand, how do you expect these people to protect, you know, what is now critical infrastructure, you know, without actually having the mechanisms in place to support giving them the information that they do need? And yeah, clearly processing their clearances in reasonable time would seem to be a thing that you could get the hell on with. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just not sure what the best path forward is here, because I would think, you know, I mean, a lot of this stuff that we've found out about is, you know, I mean, it's not classified, right? So I just wonder if that's a legit sticking point. Someone's been having some fun typo squatting on NPM repos, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, I mean, NPM, which is the centralized kind of package registry for the Node.js platform, that's actually a real issue with supply chain attacks over the last little while. There was a talk, I think, last KiwiCon about hijacking packages in the NPM. But yeah, someone's been registering packages or uploading packages to the NPM with very, very close names to the originals. So, for example, there's a package called crossenv with a hyphen, and someone registered a package crossenv without a hyphen, which had like a callback, which would give away your passwords to the attacker. Anyway, they did it with a bunch of other packages on the platform. And yeah, people are getting known. But yeah, we've seen this kind of thing crop up before, you know, in a number of guises on the NPM. But yeah, it's sort of a general symptom of supply chain attacks that we're seeing people carrying out.
Yeah, look, supply chain stuff's really interesting in software. And I remember having conversations with Chris Weissopel, founder of Veracode, about this many years ago. And that was something that they got wise to very early on, is just the amount of code reuse and how vulnerable supply chains in software are. And look, sticking with that theme, we've got a piece here from Dan Gooden over at Ars Technica talking about this, an issue that actually came up a few weeks ago on the show, Adam, which is this issue of Chrome extensions and plugins.
Yeah, this was another story, another Chrome extension that had been compromised or had its account in the Chrome store where you get the extensions from compromised. In this case, someone phished an employee of the people who make the CopyFish browser extension. They did like optical character recognition or something. Anyway, they sent a Google like password reset phishing mail to them. They weren't using two-factor auth on the account so that they used to log into the web store, got the account owned, and then the application was modified to include, you know, kind of adware that would serve ads to people who use the extension. And then those updates are pushed out automatically by the extension web store thing. So yeah, another example of supply chain against the against Google Chrome plugins, which of course, I mean, given that Chrome is arguably the best browser at the moment, is not a good look for what is otherwise a good piece of the ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, the story we spoke about a few weeks ago, I mean, this was an account compromise, but the story we spoke about weeks ago was just orphaned projects. So, you know, you've got a bit of a double threat there, you know?
Didn't some guy sell one of his extensions that was no longer being maintained or something?
Yeah. Oh, now we've got a story doing the rounds here, which is a bit of a case study, really, on how the FBI investigates, online creepers. This guy who was calling himself Brian Kill managed to get himself busted by playing a media file that was rigged by the FBI to do some sort of callback. I'm presuming that's some sort of DRM trick, because often media players, you know, you can actually get them to call out for authorization to DRM servers outside of Tor. So that was what they did in this case. And yeah, this guy's been done, thank God, because he sounds like a real horror show dude.
Yeah, no, he certainly does sound like someone who is well deserving of the network investigative technique. In this case, yeah, it's not clear whether it was an exploit or whether it was, like, as you say, like a license file, URL, or subtitles or some other sort of metadata of the video file. But yeah, they uploaded the malicious video file to his Dropbox, and then he accessed it via Tor. It called back outside Tor, and now he's going to jail. So, well, I mean, he's being prosecuted and will go to jail, presumably, given that he does sound, as you said, like a jerk.
Yeah, he's one of those, sextortionists who, God, I'm never going to even describe the crimes because they're just so horrible, right? So, yeah, hope he has a horrible time in prison, you jerk. Okay, from something speaking really, really depressing. From something really, really depressing to something really, really funny. So, we've got all these amazing cloud offerings from companies like Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. So Cisco's getting in on that action, and they're off to a great start.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, Cisco had a cloud component of their Meraki, like, wireless management product that lets you, like, the thing we're doing, like, centralized management of your wireless network. You upload, like, floor plans of your wireless, of your buildings, and do, signal maps of your environment and do customized login portal, all that kind of thing. It's truly the future of being able to manage your network in the network. Anyway, so they, all of this data that was used in their network management platform, their wireless bits, was in the cloud. And one of Cisco's fine engineering staff, I managed to RM it all. Turns out, I guess, because it's an object store, not a file system, that you want to back up. And because who backs up in the cloud anyway? It's all cloud these days. You don't have to worry about that. Anyway, turns out they didn't have any backups either. And it's all gone. And they don't actually even know what's gone other than it's just gone burger. If you use Cisco's cloud-based wireless system for their Meraki product, I think that was an acquisition a while ago. You might find that, I don't know, like your login page doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Good one, Cisco.
Nicely done. They also fixed, Cisco also fixed about 15 bugs this week in a dozen products. Anything interesting in there?
One of them apparently was an auth bypass in their identity services engine, which is like their centralized auth mechanism. You kind of had one job, centralized auth mechanism, which was not to give out like super admin privileges when someone just logs in from the outside. So yeah, bad Cisco on that one. There's a couple of bugs also in their OSPF implementation, which, like actual protocol bugs in kind of dynamic routing protocols. Given, Cisco buys a lot of rubbish products from other people, like, and rebadges them and sells them, but like core actual routing is kind of what you're supposed to get right, Cisco. So yeah, bugs in their OSPF. I'm not sure they're super planet melty ones, but come on.
Now look, our final story of the week, Adam, what we like to call a skateboarding dog story. I don't know if that quite works. It's not quite a skateboarding dog. It's a little bit more risque. Please walk us through this one.
We talked, I think, maybe, was it Black Hat last year, about some of the research on cloud-connected sex toys and the fact that they don't preserve privacy very well and that some of the vendors are, in fact, collecting usage data from them, intimate usage data, which is not a particularly good look. Anyway, so there's been a bunch of research around, the internet of sexy toy things over the last little while. This particular story covers someone who has used Tor to connect to their internet-controlled dildo and use that to control it in a manner that preserves privacy and anonymity. And to do so, not just did they use Tor, they used a Ricochet.
You're welcome, world.
Yes, for those of you not familiar, the Ricochet is a project that Pat's been intimately involved in, which is an instant messenger that runs over Tor using hidden services to preserve, sources talking to journalists, for example, preserve their identity and avoid causing metadata. So yes,
or alternatively, for controlling dildos.
For controlling dildos. So top work, Pat.
Because that's exactly what we had in mind when we did all that hard work. But there you go. You can go off and get off with the Ricochet-controlled dildo. Happy days. Just before we wrap it up, too, I just want to mention that O'Reilly's security conference is coming up in late October in New York, and we've got a discount code that listeners can use to get a discount on Rego for that conference. It's a 20% discount, and you just use the code RISKB, R-I-S-K-B. So there you go. Just a little bonus for all of you out there in listener land. But Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Bit of a light week this week. It's part of the, post-Vegas hangover. But thanks a lot for joining us, as always, and I'll chat to you again next week.
Oh, you certainly shall. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, before we continue, just a quick update on all things commercial over here at Risky Biz HQ. I'm waiting to hear back from a couple of existing sponsors, but it looks like this like weekly show is already oversubscribed with sponsors until 2019. So that is terrific news. As for Snake Oilers and Soapbox, our new podcasts, our Soapbox series is booked out until the end of this year, and we've already secured sponsorship for 5 of 10 Soapbox editions that are running next year. If you do want one of them in 2018, you should let us know quickly. And it also looks like half of our Snake Oilers slots for 2018, they're already gone. The next edition of Snake Oilers is later this month. That's already sold out, but we've got a couple of slots left for November this year, and then reasonable availability for next year. But look, it's early August and it's already filling up. So if you are a vendor and you want to get involved in Risky Business, do let me know soon, because demand at the moment is just frankly insane. I'm thinking of adding one more advertising product into the mix, and I'm keen to hear from listeners on whether they think it's a good idea or not. I thought between the news and the feature interview, like this time right now, I could open up about 2 minutes just for announcements. Something along the lines of, hey, Vendor X just released this new product. They've just announced it. Conference Y has a call to papers. Check that out here. And, you know, huge megacorp Z is hiring in Chicago, blah, 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 blah. So I'm just thinking of that because, you know, honestly, because our other stuff is just filling up. And it's a fairly non-intrusive thing that I can't imagine would tick people off too much. But if you hate the idea, do let me know. I'm on Twitter at @riskybusiness, one word. And that is the housekeeping done for the week. On to this week's feature interview now. I actually recorded this interview a few weeks ago, but I bumped it to make room for the Australian Prime Minister's cybersecurity advisor, Alastair McGibbon. I bumped it to make way for that interview. So this interview is with Kelly Shortridge, who until very recently was BAE's product manager for cross-platform detection capabilities. If you ever meet Kelly, I'd highly recommend asking her for her opinion on detection-related products, because it's a space that she knows insanely well. But her talk at Black Hat was more about detection principles. Chiefly, Kelly thinks the way some people attempt to apply game theory principles to detection is just plain wrong. Here's what she had to say in the weeks leading up to Black Hat.
Yes, so I'm going to be speaking about why it should no longer be time for game theory, and why all the thought leadering using Nash equilibrium and some of the game theory 101 analyses are very flawed and actually lead to highly problematic and inefficient defensive strategies. And instead, we need to be thinking about the fact that both sides are human. We have to account for attacker cognition. There are actually a lot of ways defense can leverage that in building really, really smart strategies, taking into account insights from behavioral game theory, which looks at a lot of experimental data on different game scenarios. So it's essentially dismantling game theory 101 and then proposing a new framework in its stead.
You just mentioned a whole bunch of terms there that I completely do not understand. I don't really even know what game theory is beyond two words that wankers often put together. but let's start with like Nash equilibrium. What the hell is a Nash equilibrium, and where do I buy one, and what does it do?
Yeah, so I guess at a high level, Nash equilibrium, well, first I should say it relies on a lot of assumptions. So first is that everybody is super rational. They're great thinking machines. The second is that everybody knows kind of everything about the game. So you can see what the other player's doing and you can formulate your strategy that way. And essentially what it says is that you'll choose your strategy based on what you think the payoff is, and in a way where if you made a different move, it wouldn't maximize your utility in any other way. So it's essentially a very static game where you say, okay, in this very specific scenario, I know everything going on. And based on this, no matter what the move the other person plays, I know I want to play, you know, X or Y strategy. Describing it that way, it's super simplistic.
Yeah, so it assumes that people essentially make perfect decisions to maximize their advantage in a game where everybody knows the rules.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody knows what the other person's going to do, or even what they could do.
I guess what you're going to get to is that, you know, attackers might not necessarily always make the best decisions, and they might not always know what the hell they're doing. I mean, is that kind of where you're going with this, or am I completely wrong?
Yeah, that's completely right. And it's actually both sides sort of have no idea what they're doing, and they have no idea what the other side's doing. And I think what I talk about, too, is a lot of times I think defense gets very pessimistic about the information asymmetry and, you know, the abilities of attackers to know the vulnerabilities ahead of time, you know, O-Day, all this FUD. Whereas I think what's overlooked is defense actually does or should have huge information asymmetry because they actually understand the environment. The attacker has to learn that. And so it's keeping in mind that the attackers, you know, they have risk profiles. They don't understand what defense is going to do. So it's starting to delve into what are the strategies to trip up the attacker's decision making, to not even let them get to the point where they understand your environment enough to, you know, carefully craft their attack.
You mentioned that people apply these principles in a way that is, you know, not very good. And hence, that's why we're moving into the 202. Can you give us an example of the 101 and how it's misused?
Yeah, sure. So some of the insights from Nash Equilibrium, for example, it's like move really aggressively and really quickly. That's the best strategy. I would argue that's often a horrible strategy in defense because you won't actually know all the information. You won't know if it's the right move. Sometimes it's actually good to see what the attacker does next and to try to lure them into a certain way, you know, set up things appropriately. So I think that's a very misguided one. I think in general, you see a lot of some of the, I guess, the fixed strategies that you see in the industry, you know, recommending, you know, very what I would call static playbooks. You know, you need to have, you know, these sorts of point solutions, whatever else. It's from a mentality that there's kind of one, you know, solved solution to the game. And this is how you, you know, play against the attacker's moves, which I argue that kind of every game is different. And that doesn't mean that you have to have a different strategy every single time, but it means you have to have certain strategies that are very adaptive and flexible for a variety of quote unquote game scenarios, which I don't think we have today.
Now, I like having these sort of academic discussions about theory, but how would that translate? Okay, so you've got a more flexible approach. You've moved up into your game theory 202. How do we take that sort of academic concept and apply it to a real world defense? Can you give us a scenario?
Yeah, sure. So I give a lot of examples in my talk, so I don't want to spoil it entirely. But one thing I have
just spoil it partially.
Before,
we'd really appreciate it.
Yeah. So I touched on this a little bit at Troopers when I gave my talk. Decision trees, I think, are something that sounds, I guess, very simplistic, but it has been shown through behavioral game theory. The evidence has shown that mapping out and even just putting yourself into the other player's shoes, thinking about how are they going to act, showing if I do, you know, this move, if I do move X, how is the attacker going to respond, and map out all their possible decisions, map out what your counter moves would be and so forth until you get to the point where the attacker gets to the pot of gold or whatever else. And really starting to think, you know, it's called belief prompting. So basically you think in different steps. So step one thinking would be, you know, okay, the attacker is going to first, like, try SQL injection, something like that. But you need to think about, okay, if we have some preventative measure to that, what will they do next? You need to keep iterating out. And for decision trees, for example, I argue that having some sort of codified way of putting that those assumptions onto, like, a whiteboard or a mind map, I suggest a few things, is a great way to have kind of a feedback loop. And even, you know, if you use red teams or pen testing teams, you can start to revise your model, start to see what attack trees or attack paths are used more often, start to see what works, what doesn't. Are you guiding, you know, the attacker down the hardest path possible? Trying to see commonalities across counter defenses that help across, like, a variety of different attack paths, really trying to get into what's the highest, I would call, return on security investment. You know, how are we improving our defensive posture over time? I think they have, as you can see, a ton of different applications. But that's something I think very basic that in game theory, it's like, oh, we already know what the attacker will do. But this is saying, no, we have an idea maybe of the different paths attackers can take. We can assign probabilities, but it's also something we can refine over time based on behaviors we observe.
So I guess what you're saying is that this isn't necessarily something you want to be doing while an attack is underway. This is more of a tabletop planning exercise.
Yeah, and I would say if you do get breached, you absolutely should go back and have a reflective exercise, see where your assumptions were wrong. But I think one place this is really applicable is ahead of time, you know, testing these assumptions and making sure you have enumerated all the possible paths and, you know, you have kind of architected your strategy. Again, it's the thought leader thing, you know, raise the cost to the attacker, but actually show on a graph, like, here's
show your work, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is the highest cost path for the attacker. What are we doing to guide them to that path?
Now, I understand, Kelly, you're also going to be talking about how it's possible to, I hate using the word deception, right? I hate using that word because there's a whole bunch of silly companies making silly stuff that call themselves deception companies. But you're saying that it's possible to throw attackers off in some meaningful ways by making soft targets look more like hard targets. Is that right? Or making them look dangerous?
Yeah, that's correct. So a lot of malware these days looks specifically for any sort of artifacts of virtual machines or things like Cuckoo sandboxes, looking for antivirus profiles. And the malware specifically won't execute if it sees any of those. So what I've been proposing is putting quote unquote wolf skins on the sheep. So taking those artifacts of virtual machines or sandboxes and putting them on all of your systems. So just a hollow looking, you know, it's whatever executable applies to VirtualBox or VMware, and that way the malware, when it's doing its checks, will think that it's in a malware analyst sandbox, but it isn't. So you're buying yourself at least a little bit of time for attackers to then figure out how they can start to detect those sorts of things more accurately.
And I'm guessing that this, you know, ties back in nicely to the idea of the game theory stuff, because you're changing the game. You're changing the information available to the attacker. The information that they're going to make their decisions on, at least.
Yeah, exactly. So anyone, regardless of attack or defender, makes decisions based on thinking or learning. So this is really what I call learning exploitation, where you're messing with, as you said, the attacker's ability to profile the system, how they can actually learn in repeated games. You're making it so they have no idea what to do. And taking that whole concept a step further is bringing in the idea of non-determinism. People are probably familiar with ASLR. I'm applying it to a higher level, where instead of it's a virtual box sandbox every time that you're emulating, it's one time it's VirtualBox, one time it's VMware, one time it's Cuckoo. So you're really impeding the ability for the attacker to figure out what sort of environment they're actually in.
So your job is in detection. So I'm guessing you would have actually put this approach into practice here and there. Were there any sort of unexpected hiccups trying to take the theory and turn it into, you know, a step-by-step reality? I'm guessing that, you know, if you start working out with some of these decision trees, the advantage is you're going to spot blind spots. I mean, that's why I can sort of see how someone who works in detection would find this useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is useful. And I think for any company on their product side, you have to consider you're tackling an overall market, and you can get hyper specific. Like, I could create decision trees very specific to a certain industry or company profile, but you have to create something that's broad enough for everyone to digest. So it's really, you have to kind of aggressively prioritize. And that's part of my job as a product manager. You have to prioritize, for example, if we think in the decision tree context, it's like, okay, which of the paths do we want to think about? Which of the existing gaps do we think most companies have in common, and how can we fill those gaps? And one thing that we're doing as well is also thinking about how can we show through kind of a certain processes, how we translate quote unquote threat intelligence, which on its own may not be actionable, in a way that actually, becomes detection content. And how do you prioritize what those, threats are? And you can do it, I think, in certain ways, but I think a lot of people, it's just kind of like, oh yeah, it'd be nice to, you know, detect X, Y, Z without thinking about it from, for example, like the attacker cost perspective. So I think, again, it kind of all goes back to, I think, the one of the better applications of game theory is, you have to think about, and I would call this probably behavioral game theory, not traditional game theory, but you have to think about your opponent. In some ways, it's like empathy, but you're trying to kind of screw them over and gain a strategic advantage, but you have to think about it from the other person's perspective. And I think very few companies do that, and I think very few product companies do that. But if you can do it in a way, basically, if you can enable other companies or your customers to do that, I think that's very powerful, and it's something that meaningfully helps companies.
So you have to unleash your inner Hannibal Lecter, you know, the whole full empathy, full stack empathy. So I'd imagine you've walked through some of these decision trees in the past. What is an actionable step that you recommended after walking through one of these tabletop exercises? Was there a point where you said, we need to change the way we're doing detection at this point in the network because look here at this point on the decision tree?
Yeah, so I can think, for example, abstractly, you start to see across various decision trees, if it's just about, you know, attacker landing on some sort of box, you can start to see when you're mapping out all these different decision trees for various types of attackers or scenarios or assets that, oh, hey, like, you know, having some sort of two-factor authentication shows up a lot. And one thing I mentioned in a few different talks is the idea of, you know, really tackling the low-hanging fruit is that even quote-unquote sophisticated attackers, I think there have been examples of this where they'll still use the same methods that less sophisticated people do. Like, why not? Why blow your O-day if you can still just, you know, do some sort of basic phishing? Most people.
Yeah, I mean, if you can hack like it's 1999 and win, then hack like it's 1999.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah,
exactly. So people, I think, focus on the really niche threats, but really once you see it at the decision tree level, it's like, oh, there are actually kind of some basic steps that we see across the board. That's probably a good return on security investment. We should probably do that. And I think it's changing the mindset from, you know, looking at the, you know, the very niche probabilities in the tree and really seeing like, okay, you know, let's assign a probability of how much this will work, like how likely it is to happen from the attacker's perspective. And again, seeing kind of that low hanging fruit and the idea of, again, it's all about raising the cost of the attacker. And I think as much as you can do that through things that you see, again, it's the commonalities across the tree. What can you do that will kind of affect every quote unquote game scenario? I think that's pretty powerful and obviously helps you. Yeah.
All right, Kelly Shortridge. The talk is called Big Game Theory Hunting, the Peculiarities of Human Behavior in the InfoSec Game. Thanks a lot for coming onto the show to preview your talk, and we'll see you in Vegas.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited.
That was Kelly Shortridge there. She has secured a new position too, and she'll be announcing that in coming weeks. So congratulations, Kelly. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Zane Lackey, the co-founder of Signal Sciences. This is a company that makes very well-respected tech in the web server and web application security space. Zane has a long history in both security consulting and working in-house on security teams, and that experience shows in the Signal Sciences product. It's hard to know what to call said product, actually. They hate it when people describe what they do as next-generation WAF, but sure, that's one way. Other people might call it a RASP play. They also hate that. But I can say this. Zane says 95% of Signal Sciences customers run the software out of the box in full blocking mode and they don't have any issues. And yeah, it's not just used for blocking attacks and detecting weirdness. It's also really good at knocking out a lot of general, you know, website abuse. So it'll block bots and automated account related abuse, that sort of stuff, as well as the usual, you know, WAFI protections against OWASP related issues. But yeah, another reason I find Signal Sciences pretty interesting as a company is because they're riding that DevOps train, but more on the ops side of security, not necessarily the dev side of security. There's a lot of companies out there offering software security and quality tools, but not so many that are focused on DevOps-friendly ops security tools. God, that's a word sandwich right there. So yeah, like a lot of the companies making static analysis and software security tools, Signal Sciences are trying to make their products more user-friendly for non-security people. It's all about making different business groups under the tech umbrella at large organizations more security self-sufficient. Zane explains.
We have to learn from the mistakes of kind of security products and tooling of the last 15, 20 years, which have been focused on only being consumed by security experts. And the challenge for us today is that security's job has really shifted from being this kind of outsourced gatekeeper, right? They're kind of, folks throw code over the wall to them or infrastructure or architecture or anything like that. Security's role has really fundamentally changed to empowering the different teams in the organization and making them security self-sufficient. And so to your question, kind of through that lens, then it really becomes, how can we provide visibility of what's going on with our applications, what's going on with our infrastructure in a way that brings security context, but is usable not only by security people, but by the DevOps teams and by the development teams themselves.
See, now what you're saying right now is just evidence, further evidence of this massive pivot that I've noticed. Because of course, you know, I deal with a lot of marketing managers. And what's been amazing for me over the last couple of years is all of these companies that made security tools for security teams, particularly in application security, their whole marketing approach has pivoted towards advertising towards developers, right? So this idea that the dev teams are the ones who are actually handling security now. But depending on who you speak to, this is either a rock solid trend or a pipe dream. Like, what have you observed?
I think there's two. I think what we need to do is look at the other side of it, which is what are the pressures that are actually driving that? And having been in the trenches for my entire career on this side, I'd say there's two key pressures that anyone in security feels there. One is that the rate of change in terms of how fast applications are being created and delivered is increasing. So things are getting faster over time there. At the same time, it's nearly impossible to hire security people. So from the security side, you know, you feel very constrained because we all have open headcount. Everyone's trying to hire. There's not enough people to go around. And yet at the same time, applications aren't getting slower, right? People, the business isn't saying, oh, let's hold off and not ship a new application this year or this month or this week, right? Those are increasing at the same time that we can't scale our security teams. So then back to kind of the focus, which is the only way we really scale security efforts is by directly making it our security efforts consumable and usable by the development teams and by the DevOps teams themselves. And so that's why I really feel like, you know, take the marketing bit out of it, like why this is a trend that is, I think we're only seeing the start of it, is that, you know, these pressures are happening regardless of what security does. So security is really effective. Security organizations are really thinking about how do I empower, because that's the only way that my security goals really get achieved.
How much of this is management, you know, non-technical management coming down to the developer teams and saying, you know, you've got to make this secure. The developer teams are saying, we don't know how. And then the management says, well, you're smart, you're computer guys, figure it out. Is that kind of what's happening?
So it's always the blend of kind of culture and all lump kind of culture and policy and all that into one side, and then technical, you know, the tools and the techniques on the other side. If you try just one without trying to adapt the other, you're in for some pretty spectacular failures. I say as someone who has lived through spectacular failures, but you have to kind of think about both at once. And so I think where security has a responsibility to live up to it is we as security practitioners have always said security is everyone's responsibility, which I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who disagrees with that. But the problem is that at the same time, the only, you know, tools and products and techniques that we've been able to provide to the rest of the organization, they can really only be consumed by security experts. And so this is where I think security has kind of a focus for its next several years, is thinking about, okay, if security is everyone's responsibility, well, we have to give them the tools and the techniques and the process and the culture to be able to actually make it, to actually live up to that responsibility.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because both HPE Fortify and Veracode, the most recent changes they've made to their products, both companies have introduced more developer-friendly tools. And when I say developer-friendly, they've sort of like detuned the output of their scanners to be more parsable to developers and only alerting them on the most egregious stuff, right? So yeah, that's interesting, because their customer has changed. And funnily enough, like, they sponsored this show not for the traditional security audience, but for the actual developer component of this audience, which is surprisingly large, right? So
yeah,
it is interesting that we're actually starting to see some of these same tools. They're like, well, we could just take this tool. It's the same tool, but we're just going to change the way that this thing outputs to make it, you know, less of a security person thing and more of a developer person thing.
Definitely. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, which is that, you know, making it where results are directly consumable. I mean, let's all flash back to scenarios that I think plenty of us have lived, which is you flash back to kind of the early days of commercial static analysis tools. And the security team would go run that on the build server once a month. You get a 10,000 page Fortify output, and you'd forward that to the dev teams, and they would be kind of earnest at first, and they would start through, and the first 10, you know, issues were all false positives, and then they look and see it's a 10,000 page report, and they're like, okay, well, this is garbage. This is a waste of my time. I'm going to flag these emails as spam if they come from security and contain an attachment.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
I'm with you. It's just, we've spent a bit of time talking about the dev security part in DevOps, but you guys, what's interesting, I guess, is that Signal Sciences is more on the ops part of security when it comes to DevOps. Like, how have you managed to create ops tools that you feel developers are gonna like, right? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. I think so much of that, again, kind of like our initial story, just came from being in the trenches there and being so frustrated with vendors that it was all the results that we got were, you know, only understandable and parsable by security folks. To using the tools, it was, you know, they had no access control in the tools, so you couldn't even give people accounts on there. It could only be like one senior ops person and one senior security person. What we've really found is you have to, and this is why we've seen so much adoption from the development side, from the DevOps side, and from the security side, is that no one needs another security tool that you've got to go remember to log into once a week. You need to be thinking about how, if you're bringing security value, how does it meet the rest of the organization where they already are? So how do you plug into that DevOps tool chain that folks are already using, whether that's Slack or PagerDuty or Jira or Datadog or things like that? And providing both the data in a way that's consumable, but through the services that folks already use, so that you're not trying to ask people to impose new cost and remember to check a security tool once a week.
I'm getting the vibe that, you know, because back in the day you were at Etsy, you know, you've also do have a long background in security consulting. So, you know, you don't come from the development background, right? You very much come from the consulting and security and up to your ears in all sorts of operations stuff that most developers wouldn't know. But I'm guessing perhaps during your time in-house, a lot of what you were doing was figuring out how to get the right data to the right people in a way that was digestible by them. I mean, is that sort of where a lot of this started for you?
Definitely. And I think even going back further to ISEC Partners, where I was incredibly fortunate to be able to spend time there with the organization and with the folks I got to work with. And that was really early on when I learned a very powerful lesson, which is some of the best security folks I've met in my career are those who really came from the development and from the operations side. And so because they could really take that data and speak it in a language that, you know, that the teams that we were trying to talk to could really understand. And so I was really fortunate to learn a lot of those lessons even before my time as a CISO at Etsy. It was during the ISEC Partners days of really learning about, hey, we're all ultimately going for the same goal here, which is how do we make this software or this service or this infrastructure more secure? If we're just, you know, speaking in security jargon that no one else understands, we're not achieving our goal. And so I was really able to learn that from, thankfully, very early on, and then use those lessons learned going into Etsy and building a security program there to really think about how does security actually enable rather than just function as this gatekeeper.
So I guess my final question is, how do we then turn this? Okay, so we've got the static analysis and software quality tools at the development phase. We've got the monitoring and visibility using software like yours, right, during the operations phase. How do you actually then turn that into a meaningful feedback loop, right? Because has anyone actually been able to close that circuit in a sensible way yet?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what you see from modern, kind of the modern software security organizations inside companies, is that they're really thinking about how do we take this data, use it as a feedback loop. And so, you know, I'll give you my own really early lesson learned on this one, which is from the security perspective, you're always thinking, okay, well, let's kind of make a gut call on what we think the most risky parts of a given application or API service or anything is. And we're doing this, you know, all really off of our gut feeling. Now, those gut feelings are usually pretty good from, you know, experience and everything like that, and thinking about where would we attack and everything there. But what was fascinating for me is the more that we started to invest in getting this sort of visibility, understanding where our real live attackers were actually targeting our applications, in a ton of cases, it was completely different than where we expected. And so that would really shift, you know, that would shift our security efforts, because, you know, everyone always has, you know, there's always like the mountain of bugs to get through. No one has a shortage of bugs. Prioritizing the criticals is easy. It's thinking about how do I prioritize, you know, the mediums and the lows when I have this, huge backlog of them. And the answer from the offensive side is often some of your most spectacular attacks on the offensive side are chaining together a series of low or medium severity issues into something that really ends up being spectacular. And so we were thinking about, okay, well, let's get that visibility. Once we did that, that really allowed us to much better strategically steer our efforts and say, you know, we were planning to spend a bunch of time with this team in Q2 of this year because we assume they are the highest risk bit of functionality. But what we've seen is actually 80% of our data goes to this team that we had, or 80% of our attacks rather, go to this team that we weren't really even planning to talk to for the next 6 months. Actually, what we should do is prioritize working with that team because that's where we see 80% of the attacks.
Yeah, so it's a good way to steer resources, I guess, is when you've got that visibility.
Yep. That's exactly it, right? We're all underwater in terms of our security projects. So thinking about it in terms of, you know, where is my actual risk? Not just from a vulnerability side, but really from an attack perspective.
Yeah, where are the attackers and what are they doing? And does it make us nervous?
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Zane Lackey, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's been interesting as always.
Hey, thanks again for taking the time, man. Really appreciate it.
That was Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, do go book a demo if that's something you find interesting. I'm yet to meet anyone who actually doesn't like this software, which is, that's a rare thing, let me tell you. But yeah, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.